This is Truth Be Told.
That not only are there reptilians here,
new evidence of UFO fleets.
We were close to nuclear war.
To help you transform so that you can live your highest truth.
We're not being told just because we're not ready for it.
Geo stations of frequency, vibrational.
I was a homicide detective with LAPD.
UFOs increase. Visitations. In 2022, we use DNA and fingerprints to identify people. But what about 10,000 years ago? Well, recently discovered in the White Sands National Park in New Mexico, a footprint offers a glimpse into the life of prehistoric humans. Today we have Dr. Sally Reynolds talking about the discovery of the oldest known human footprint in the Americas have been discovered. These footprints were made by kids and teenagers over 21,000 years ago. Who were these people? How did they live? When did they get here? Who are they descendants of? We may find out today, we may not, but I'm excited to share this journey with you. I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. Please welcome to the Truth Be Told studios for the first time, paleontologist Dr. Sally Reynolds.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Oh, thank you. And I'm so excited to have you here all the way for, they say, on the other side of the pond.
Yes,
in the UK.
Other side of the pond.
And, you know, like I said, for the people in the chat room, please, as we're going through, you know, ask those questions because we may miss some questions that you may want to know. And so I'd love to hear from you guys. But we're going to get started. First of all, this was a big discovery, for the world and for America. But could you talk a little bit more about the discovery that was in White Sands?
Yes. So I'd have to go back to 2016.
Let's do it.
When a wonderful man called Mr. David Bustos, who is the resource manager at White Sands National Monument, as it was in those times, approached my husband and a group of other scientists. My husband is Matthew Bennett, a group of other scientists, including myself, to be part of work at White Sands to try to properly identify the footprint evidence that was found at White Sands. Now, these footprints are visible at very specific conditions, specifically when there's a little bit of moisture. And you can see the infilling of the footprints, which are slightly darker than the rest of the footprints. And these footprint surfaces are scattered all across White Sands. It's not just a single footprint. It's literally hundreds of thousands of footprints. But our problem was that we couldn't date them. There's nothing in a footprint that is datable. You need some kind of carbon that you can do radiocarbon dating on, or other minerals that you can use, radioactive minerals for radioactive dating. And it wasn't possible to do any of that until we found these particular tracks, at which point we did an excavation into a bluff and we discovered, and this is the exciting part, a seed layer. And seeds are carbon, and carbon means you could do radiocarbon dating. And we were very excited about that. It seems crazy that you get so excited about these tiny little seeds. It was a real breakthrough in terms of the work that we were doing at the site. So we dug through that layer, we got seeds at the top, dug through the layer, found some beautiful footprints, dug under the footprints and found another beautiful seed layer, which means we could date both the maximum and the minimum age of this footprint layer. And it came out between 23 and 21,000 years. So suddenly we went from knowing that humans were at White Sands to discovering that they were in fact the oldest evidence of humans in North America so far.
And what was it before? What was the dates before?
So we always thought that it was impossible for humans to have reached North America while the ice sheets were closed.
And
the ice sheets started to open at around 16,000 years ago. And so although there were some indications of older sites, people had always said there's no way that we can get sites older than 16,000 because the routeway wasn't open. The doors were closed. The work at White Sands, specifically the dating, has shown that our understanding of how the First Nations, the first people reached North America must be wrong, that we couldn't have arrived after the last ice age. We were in fact there before the last ice age. And this has now opened an avenue of a lot of interesting new ideas. All of those older sites that people had dismissed, suddenly it looks like we should reevaluate a lot of the evidence that had previously been dismissed as impossible. And that's a very exciting place to be in our science, because suddenly that barrier, that 16K absolute hard limit, that's gone. That's out the window.
Wow. And so we talked about many times on my show, you know, the Native Americans, and I'm assuming, like you said, there are hundreds of thousands of these footprints or thousands of footprints. I'm assuming they are the ancestors of the current day Native American tribes. Is that correct? Or do we even know?
We don't know for sure. The Native American people who work in and around White Sands are stakeholders in the site. For them, it's a very important part of their heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually helping us to understand the life ways of people who live in this basin. So we work very closely with them. In terms of exactly who made the footprints, we don't know. We lack any sort of genetic evidence. What is becoming clear, though, is that the colonization of the Americas was probably a very complex, multi-stage process. And that rather than just say there was one group of people who moved into North America using one route, we should probably realize it was a complex pattern involving lots of different smaller migrations, some of them successful and leaving ancestors and DNA lineages which exist into the present day, and some which have left no trace. We call these ghost lineages. So the idea that there was one successful migration into North America and only one route is probably oversimplifying a very complex process.
Now, what part of the park is this in? Is there one area that's, because I'm not, I've been there when I was a kid, so I can't remember how big the White Sands it is, but is there one area that you're finding the most, or is it just all throughout the park?
It's all throughout the park.
Wow.
I mean, it's absolutely phenomenal. Plus, as you know, it abuts the White Sands Missile Range. And one of the other trackways that we worked on, which is the mom carrying the toddler, which is the longest human trackway that's ever been discovered, that trackway actually runs out into the missile range. So it's pretty clear that on their land as well, there are more prints there. It's like the whole area is just full of footprints with these different stories that they could be telling.
So when was the missile installed? Because surely they saw that way before that people, you know, you guys discover this.
Oh, yes. And I think as far as I know, and I might be speaking under correction here, but they actually have their own staff archaeologists on their staff. And until very recently, there's not been any desire to work cooperatively between the two teams.
Wow.
But it may actually be now that we have an opportunity to explore more widely and to share our findings with the group on the other side of the fence, and hopefully create an even larger picture of how these humans were moving through their landscape. What we do know is that they were on this landscape over thousands of years, and they kept coming back. And this, for me, is very interesting, because the question is why. There is a source of water there, so that's Paleo Lake Otero, which is now dried up. And it's a reasonably arid environment around it, which means less vegetation, and large animals coming to drink are very easy to spot and probably hunt. So in terms of human hunting behavior and being able to ambush prey, being situated at White Sands is a very good suite of features which may enable hunting to be conducted effectively and reliably. And this may explain why the humans continued to come back to White Sands over thousands of years.
21,000 years, I mean, we can see in 100, 200, 300, 500 years, you know, we were talking about, you know, the biggest drought that the UK or the Europe have seen in 500 years. 21,000 years, terrain can change a lot. So was it 21,000 years ago? Do you feel it was a little more, you know, not tropical or forest? Because where I'm from in Kansas, my brother actually, he was a big fossil hunter growing up. And right outside my hometown in Kansas, they call it the Flint Hills, he found a petrified palm leaf. So it showed that there was tropical at one time, and there also is quite a few, you know, petrified fish and stuff like that. So, and, you know, even though New Mexico is quite a bit south of Kansas, I don't know how old that palm leaf was, but 21,000 years ago, what was it like?
Well, that's a good question, and that's something that the team is continuing to work on because it helps us understand what the humans were eating, what they were hunting, what sort of food, plant food, animal food, what sort of building materials, the construction of their dwellings, what raw materials do they need. So the short answer is to come back to those rupia seeds that we used to date those footprints. Rupia is a ditch grass.
Some grassy.
And the ditch grass grows in sort of swampy conditions.
Yeah, right.
So we think that they would have been Paleolegatero and then this swampy, grassy tufts around the margins.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would have been the White Sands that we have today. So that wouldn't have changed. Those very thin gypsum soils would be no good for growing forests. So it's quite limited in terms of that. Trying to understand what the rest of the landscape looked like, we're exploring a range of what we call paleoenvironmental proxies. But it really is just a way of looking through the sediment to see if there are any fine, tiny clues.
Mm-hmm.
Bone preservation is absent at the site at the moment.
I was going to ask you that, if there's any type of bone burial, you know, beads.
Nothing yet, but we keep looking. We're so open to any and all discoveries. What we have found potentially is pollen preservation.
Oh, really?
And so pollen preservation, because the pollen, the shape of the pollen grains is not unique, but it can give you an indication of the family of the plant that it comes from. That could really help us reconstruct the paleo environment and to answer the questions about, you know, were there trees there? What sort of plants were there? And there must have been, you know, enough vegetation to feed things like mammoths. We have mammoth tracks. The giant ground-dwelling sloth, although it would have been a terrifying animal to behold, is actually vegetarian. So, you know, herbivore, it needs plant food.
Right.
Actually uses those claws to climb up into the trees. And
so there must have been something.
Ground. Exactly. And there must have been food there for them, you see. So these are some of the questions that we're trying to focus on in future research work.
So for the people that are going to listen to the podcast, I'm going to show a picture, and it looks like they're in the middle of the White Sands. It looks like some type of rock, so I don't know if it's just hardened sand, and they've dug down maybe 2.5 to 3 feet. So was the footprints on the surface and then digging deeper, was this to find the seeds, or is this to find, because it would be hard to find other footprints underneath, if because you need it more flat than vertical.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
So what you can see there is that there's a slight slope.
Right.
But the footprint trail was on the surface and then ran into a bluff.
Okay.
And the decision was taken to follow the footprint surface into the bluff, and that enabled it to be exposed at depth, so you could get that very precious profile in the trench, which is what you need, because you need to see where the layers of sediment are, where the layers of seeds are in relation to where you know the footprint surface is. Now, it would be impossible to do if you just had one or two isolated footprints. But it is possible to do because we have so many footprints on the White Sands landscape. But finding the footprints and then finding the two seed layers, that was just magic. That was absolutely brilliant.
All right. So I'm sure people are going to ask this. So if it had some grass, maybe some trees, well, it had to have been a little muddy. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to believe that that mud did not get washed away in other rain coming, because we've seen, you know, I grew up in the country and I've seen walking through the mud and then the rain comes and it washes that completely out. So how did that stay to where it actually gotten hardened enough? So it had to have been quite a few, a thousand years before it, mm-hmm. I don't know how fast sand or mud turns to rock.
Yeah. It's a good question. So remember you were talking about your brother finding these fossilized palm
right.
leaves. So fossilization potential is really driven by the geology and the things that are in the sediment, which right. can help fossilize. In this case, it appears that there's perhaps a salt crust that's in the gypsum sands themselves. Mm. And the combination of salt and heat is then baking it into this shape, which can remain fixed in time. There must have been hundreds of thousands of prints that were lost because of mud or over trampling, as you say, that just weren't able to survive. But it's also a landscape where there is relatively little movement on the surface. And once those tracks are probably covered up, it is remarkable that 21,000 years has passed.
Right.
And those footprints have lain there undisturbed. But if this was a big city with concrete and right. car parks and disruption, it would perhaps have not survived in the way that it has. So it's partly due to the unique preservation potential of the gypsum itself, and it's partly to do with the relative aridity of the area, that people are not queuing up to live at White Sands, which is perfect for keeping things pristine and for keeping things preserved for long periods of time.
Well, we do have a question from the chat room that this is interesting. First, Andrea said, have you visited the site, or have they just sent you data and samples for you to research and test?
I'm unfortunately the one team member who doesn't get to spend a lot of time in the field, because I have a 4-year-old girl. Right? So what I tend to do is I get sent pictures and data from the field, and I get to do a lot of searching to support the work that is happening in the field. But my husband is out there doing the legwork. So we do teamwork, basically. And I'd love to spend more time in the field, but at the moment with a very young family,
right.
it just isn't practical.
How important are these footprints? Because I've heard people like, what's it matter of footprints? Why do I care? So why is it important that we find these discoveries of our past?
I think the past is almost like a mirror, actually. It makes us learn about ourselves. And I'll give the example of the longest human trackway, which was the mom mm-hmm. trudging through the mud, carrying this child, putting this child down every 100 meters or so, two little baby feet appearing in the sediment and then being lifted up again, probably while mom or dad are trying to adjust and make themselves a bit more comfortable. And I found that very relatable, this possibly sickly, crying child and the mother of a parent trying desperately to get to perhaps the next settlement to find help for the sick child.
Mm.
And I found that very relatable. So the more you look at the past, you think it was very different, and I can't possibly understand what their lives were like that long ago. I have nothing in common with these people. But then you find these commonalities, and one of them is parenthood, and trying to imagine these young teenagers hanging out. And these would be the oldest prints, the ones we've just found. Those teenagers were not doing anything. They were just milling around, chatting with their friends. It's a very teenagery thing to do. And you think to yourself, they're just like us. They're just sitting around, shooting the breeze, looking at the animals, just generally having fun. And we've seen that moment. So I think the past connects us with times long gone, but also helps us to see the universality of what it means to be human, what it means to live these lives, what's important to us all. And ultimately, we don't like to think about it, but one day we'll be in the past. Yeah, there's that mom. Yeah. Stressed out mom with a sickly baby, all by herself on that landscape, walking very fast through thick mud that was causing her to slip. It was a very torturous journey. And straight line out and straight line back. And the child's prints are present on the outbound journey. The child's prints are absent on the return journey, which I think strongly suggests that the child is the purpose for the journey and that the child was perhaps too sick to walk. The first thing I asked my little girl to do is, come on, you walk for a bit now. And this mom wasn't doing that, which means the baby was probably very ill. And she was probably seeking help from another village. And I think a lot about her. I've never met her. And I think a lot about that situation of being worried for your child. I think that's something we can all relate to. So it is a footprint, but it's also a touchstone with the past, with a larger human experience. We're not just individuals. We're part of this grand story of the evolution of our species, a species that now wants to colonize Mars. And it's quite nice to step back from these very big achievements and focus on these tiny moments in the past that really unifies us as people, as parents, as children, even children jumping in muddy sloth puddles, just jumping in puddles just because they're there. It brings a joyfulness, I think. Our understanding of the past used to be, oh, it was all serious, it was all hard work, people were starving, everyone was miserable. But what we've seen is moments of joy, moments of pleasure. And it's really nice to have evidence of these sort of lighter moments in the past.
Oh, and yes, and I always feel I'm a big history buff, and I, even my own family tree, I think I started working on my family tree when I was 16 or 17, so 35 years ago or whatever. So, I think it's important that we do know our past and where we came from, and even though this particular set of footprints are probably not in my blood anywhere, at least for another 100,000 years maybe, but it's still interesting to see people's past. Like you said, everybody has their own story. And mothers are still mothers, no matter.
And they're still worrying about their sick children
right.
who won't walk.
What were some of the, and maybe still going on, but what are some of the most challenges when you're approaching excavation or a project like this? Is it more political state or just trying to preserve and not lose other discoveries?
So if you go back to the footprint in the trench, if you go back to that image, you can see some of the hardware that is lying around the trench, and some of them are chainsaws, and we have to cut into the sediment with chainsaws,
Oh, chainsaw, wow.
big blocks, you see, and so you have to dig it out almost like you would dig out ice for an igloo. dig it out as these big blocks with a chainsaw. And so we're dealing with hard sediment. The sediment is hard because otherwise the footprints might not have preserved as well. And the footprints themselves are very fragile and need to be protected very quickly once they've been uncovered, because immediately they're exposed to the air, they start to erode, and it's very difficult to save them. So the idea is to use structure from motion photogrammetry, which is where you take 30 or 40 or perhaps even a short film around the footprint itself, which you can then use to build a 3D digital model. Mm. The model helps you study the attributes of the individual print, but it also is a way of digitally recording each individual track. Because on the scale of white sands, how on earth would you try to preserve that large surface area? It's just, it's not physically or financially possible.
Mm. And I know we talked about the Native American part of that, but was there any one tribe that claimed? Because, I mean, back in 23,000 years ago, I'm sure many of the natives split and became different tribes. So I didn't know if there was like a one tribe or couple tribes that claimed any part of being part of this group.
Yes. So as I know it, there are about 18 or 22 tribal elders who meet frequently at White Sands and who discuss and input into the decisions that are made.
Oh.
And so I couldn't give you the names of all those tribes, but all of those tribal elders, it's what David Bustos does, is he creates this liaison between what the scientists want to achieve and what the tribal people believe is best for the land. And he's been very respectful about having these discussions so that everyone knows exactly what's happening and what the significance is of the findings. And I've been very impressed with the work that he's done to make these people feel as though we're exploring the heritage, we're not destroying it, we're not trying to exploit it. So they've been actually really understanding about trying to allow us to tell some of these stories, even though they have this much, much closer relationship with the land than we do.
Yeah, it's and that's why I was wondering, you know, before that, I know how ceremonial natives are with burials and stuff. And I'm curious one day if you will find some type of burial plots or bones or artifacts somewhere.
That would be, I mean, on the one hand, that would be amazing, because suddenly it would be a different level of evidence. But on the other hand, it would be a complete different level in terms of work that we'd need to do.
Mm-hmm.
We'd need to make sure that we were very careful. And we always are. We always are when we do this work. We're extremely careful about observing all of the guidelines, dealing respectfully with the tribes. But yes, the minute you find a skeleton, it's somebody's family member, isn't it?
Right,
and,
right.
And then it's a different set of questions you have to go through, and that may well be a challenge. Every time we've gone out to do field work at White Sands, we've come back with a new and exciting discovery. And they just keep coming, Tony. It's amazing. So, you know, today we might say, oh, we're never going to find the hearth. We have been looking for a hearth. We're never going to find the stone tools. We're never going to find a burial. We're never going to find a hut. I'd love to just have a dwelling, or at least part of a dwelling. It would absolutely thrill me. But, you know, the next field season is for a short week in September, and I might be on your show again in October.
Oh, there we go.
No idea what we found.
Well, anytime, because we would love to hear what new discoveries you found. But is it completely closed off, this area, so people, you know, us people off the street don't destroy? Because I couldn't imagine just letting anybody walk in there and graffiti and everything else that people tend to do.
We would be worried about that. And the reason was because there was another site, Trachios, in Crete, where the footprints, which were millions of years old, were announced. And shortly afterwards, the site was vandalized. So it does happen. It does happen. The the time that we've been working with the park has gone from being a national monument to being a national park. And the people who work for the parks agency have been very careful about not disclosing in any way, shape or form any diagnostic landmarks, which means that none of the information relevant to finding the individual sites can be discovered accidentally, and that they need to, people would need to come and visit the site. They'd need to make contact with people at the park, with the scientists. And that is to protect the park until longer term decisions about how we can safeguard the sites that we want to safeguard can be made. And those decisions haven't been made yet.
Well, I mean, our time's getting close to being over, and I hate to say that, but, you know, even though that we're going through a worldwide drought and climate change, there are some good things about it, because people in your field, there's becoming a lot more discoveries because water has receded, and, you know, new civilizations and all kinds of different ruins and burial. So, is it, I mean, I guess for you, that's the light, what does it say, in the shining, what does it say?
Silver lining.
Yeah, silver lining. So have you been any part of any of these new discoveries besides just the White Sands?
Well, there's this new discovery that's been made in Utah.
In Utah?
Utah, yes. And Tommy Urban, who's one of the team members on White Sands, has hopped over to Utah, and he's been looking at some of their tracks. And it's exactly as we had thought, that White Sands was special but not unique, and that there were probably lots of other footprint sites in America around Dried Up Playas just waiting to be discovered. And it seems like now people are starting to really look carefully for footprints, and suddenly people are finding them. So I'm not part of the work that's been done at Utah. I'm very excited to be a part of looking for other sites and sort of other regions of the Americas. Mm-hmm. And simply because the stories that they tell are just so fascinating, yeah, in terms of how humans manage to survive in these environments with these very large and dangerous creatures, who we then probably ended up killing too many of. And this is one of the things I'm interested in, is megafaunal extinctions and how humans may have hastened that. And I think that might be linked to how human populations gradually increased in North America. Mm-hmm. As soon as humans arrived, there were only a few of them, so they couldn't do any damage. There just literally weren't, right, enough humans. But fast forward a couple of thousand years, and you have these sort of steady, slow and steady growth. And suddenly these people are splitting out into groups of family groups across the land. And each family is hunting a sloth a week. And if you do the math, then you start to realize that it wouldn't take very long to make quite negative impacts onto these very slow growing, slow maturing, slow reproducing animals.
I mean, we did it with the buffalo and pretty much every creature on this planet for tens of thousands of years. So
it is sad. It is sad. It's like it's a human desire, I think, is almost to want to dominate the animals that we see around us. Yeah. And I'm not even sure if there was good eating on a sloth, really.
Yeah,
I'd much rather fancy, you know, a mammoth.
Right. But I'm sure that has some better meat than the sloth.
The point is that we at least we get to appreciate how these humans interacted with their landscape and what the long-term consequences were for the fauna. Now you think about the position we're in now. We're thinking about, we're driving animals to extinction, not because we're hunting the pandas, not because we're hunting the orangutans,
right,
but because we're destroying their habitat, which,
right,
amounts pretty much to the same thing. Whether you take the animal's life away or you take the habitat away, it's going to create problems.
Yeah.
And that's another reason why I think learning about the past is important, because it helps us give perspective on our modern day,
mm-hmm,
problems. And humans and the way we're changing our landscapes, converting everything to farmland, destroying natural habitats. It's good to reflect on how that is going to impact on other animals. And I do get cross when people talk about going to Mars, because there's so many beautiful creatures on this planet. Are we going to take them all to Mars?
Right.
You know, we're just going to leave them here. Right. So I do like to think that Earth is worth saving because it's not just us. It's the creatures that live in the oceans and all the birds and and all the amazing fossils. It's the whole package that I think we have to save. And I hope that in talking about the amazingness of these fossil discoveries, it might encourage people to go out and explore, go out and have a look, find us some footprints, let us know what you find. You know, there must be so much out there to discover, and it would be wonderful if more people could join us on this discovery.
And I think there's a lot of people, amateur, you know, fossil, like my brother, that loves to go out and finds, you know, native, like arrowheads and that leaf and all kinds of stuff. I remember him used to finding tons of fossils just all over the place. So,
Tell him to get out there and look for footprints.
I in Kansas, you know, the Flint Hills there might be some, because there's definitely a lot of fossils in that area, and there's a lot of native tribes that were in that area. So lots of native tribes. But the last question also comes from the chat room. What's the most rewarding part of this process, I guess, of just doing what you do? What's the most rewarding thing that you take away from what you do?
It's exciting to be able to tell people about it, because it's like you have this beautiful secret and that you've seen this really interesting thing. And so this is probably one of the best parts of the job, is where I get to tell people about this exciting thing that I found and how interesting I think it is. And it's that sort of the thrill of discovery and the thrill of talking about this interesting stuff, whether it's to school children or to other academics. And I find it really rewarding, because people are so excited when they hear about the things that we're doing. And it's one of the best parts of the job.
Well, I have to say, it's been so fascinating. I love hearing your stories. It's like sitting down and listening to your grandparents tell stories about the past, you know, your ancestors. So it's awesome. And I know you're on Twitter, and I have it there under your screen. So people, and it's Sally R underscore ISLHE. Yes. And is there any other places that you post so people might want to follow you?
Not at the moment, but I am going to be starting doing a short series of videos on TikTok.
Oh, that's good.
60-second science. We're still in the development process, but it'll be short, interesting videos about fossils, skulls.
Oh, I love it.
Deformities. So I'll make sure I let you know when we have some content.
Yeah, please do. Mine's Truth Be Told Paranormals, but on TikTok, cool. So I will definitely follow you.
Excellent. Thank you, Tony. You're my first follower.
Yes.
Yet.
Yes, I'll be watching. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Sally. And that's Dr. Sally Reynolds. And she was talking all about the new discoveries in New Mexico at the White Sands, the footprint. And I love it. So, but I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. Please watch Robert Hensley on Monday at Minutemen Report. Bonnie Burkert on Wednesday at with Truth Be Told Transformation. Of course, me here every Friday. And we have some great shows, and the Halloween season's coming up. So we have a lot of ghost stories and paranormal discoveries that we're going to be talking, maybe even a seance live on air. So we'll find out more about that soon. But until next time, thank you guys for subscribing, leaving comments, and sharing this show. Without you, we wouldn't be here. So until next time, take care of yourselves. Bye. This has been another episode of Truth Be Told. Thank you so much for watching. Recorded live at UBN Go Studios in Burbank, California. Join us on social media. Facebook, Truth Be Told Radio. Instagram, Truth Be Told Paranormal. Go to Truth Be Told Worldwide for more information on upcoming shows.